Hi, everybody. Shavuot Tov and Chodesh Tov, beginning of week and also the beginning of a new Jewish month. Today is January 29th, 2017, and the second day of Shvat, 5777. You're listening to Rejuvenation on the Land of Israel Network with Eve Harrow, broadcasting from the hills around Jerusalem. It has been raining here for the last few days. Now the sky is blue and it's sunny, but the last couple of days and all through Shabbat, we had lots of rain, and that's a good thing. January was very dry, and we're coming up to the holiday that really symbolizes this new month of Shvat. It's called Tu B'Shvat, or the 15th day of Shvat. It will fall out a week from next Shabbat on the 15th of the month. And that is, I guess you could call it Israel's Arbor Day, but to a great degree, it is, well, it's the new year for the trees. So we're a little bit loony about trees when it, in Israel, trees symbolize a lot. But we have a new year for the trees, and it turns out that the rain, and this is like scientifically proven, that the most of the rain in the winter is going to fall on Tu B'Shvat. So we need a lot of rain now so that the other half, or the little bit less than half that falls after Tu B'Shvat, will also be a lot. And it's a time of year we look around here in Israel and you see a lot of things that look like they're not, almost not alive, right? Like the trees, there's no leaves on the trees, and everything is like really stark. And it is, but it is so meaningful in terms of like the people here as well. Like you can look at things and they can look like not a whole lot is going on, but really underground, like it's, that's what's happening with the trees now, right? All their strength and all their energy, they're really hibernating so that they can burst forth in the spring, beautiful and living, and give fruit and give greenery. And you can look around and you can look at people sometimes and wonder at the potential that's inside, because people can just look like people. So one of the, obviously people can look like people, but people can look like, okay, like there's nothing special in there. But then in the right conditions, the goodness can so burst forth. And I had that, those experiences, quite a few experiences like that in the last week. I guided two trips for One Israel Fund. And as always, I'm just so amazed and feel privileged and humbled by some of the people that I meet as I take others around Judea and Samaria. We went last week, we started off in a community called Tapuach, where we met with someone who trains dogs for not just for, well, for security, but also to find people. A lot of people go missing, and we need, you know, the dogs have a tremendous ability to be able to find people. And we saw the demonstrations and how unbelievably they train the dogs for all kinds of situations there in Tapuach. And then we saw, we went and saw and investigated an ambulance that One Israel Fund had given to the community in order to, because it's very far from any hospitals, to make sure that people get the proper care. Anybody who needs it gets the proper care, more on that in a minute, to get them to where they need to go, where they can get the really proper care, like the interim. And then went to Elon Moreh, in the furthest reaches of the Shomron, the very, very east, northeastern corner of Shechem, and had lunch there, and had lunch in a beautiful winery, except that when you talk to the vintners and you understand what, why they're there. So when the vintner said flat out that what he is doing, he is, he's living the prophecy. Jeremiah 31:5, Jeremiah, that happens to be a great chapter anyway. But Jeremiah 31:5 says this: Otiti kramim b'harei Shomron, natunotim v'chilelu. Again, you shall plant vineyards on the hills of Samaria. Men shall plant and live to enjoy them. Okay, because it's not just enough to plant. Things that you plant take a long time to grow, and the laws in the land of Israel is even if they grow quickly, we can't enjoy the fruits of the land until the fourth year, and. But it's also, it's a blessing to be able to plant and then to be alive to reap. But this, what Jeremiah is saying this right before the destruction of the first temple. 2,600 years ago, he's saying this. And people are, as you can imagine, distraught because of what's going to be. And it's such, it's a prophecy of hope. And it's a prophecy of faith and of fulfillment and of God never, ever losing his faith in us as long as we don't lose his faith in him, and the ultimate partnership. And so in our day-to-day lives here in Israel, and I get to do this, this joy and this sense of wow and awe just never goes away, that I get to do this, that I get to meet people who are by their actions living out a prophecy. It's not just that the prophecy is happening. People are taking actions in order to fulfill the prophecies. Okay, this is, as again, this ultimate partnership. And even though some people are doing things without realizing that they are fulfilling a prophecy, maybe that's where the miracle is, right? Because it's happening. It is happening. But we're doing things. And so he's planting these vineyards and he's feeling like Itamar up in Elon Moray, and he's feeling like I'm helping make this come true. And then we went up to Har Kabir, which overlooks Shechem, which overlooks Nablus, and you can't see Joseph's tomb from there, but of course the tomb of Joseph is one of the places where it talks about in the Bible our kinyan, our connection to the land of Israel. Three places where it's very specific in the Bible that are bought for an everlasting covenant with the Jewish people and the land of Israel: the tomb of the patriarchs in Hebron, Joseph's tomb, the land where Joseph will be buried in Shechem, and of course, the threshing floor, the fields on Mount Moriah, which David buys, will later the temple will be built. And always, it's just astonishing how these three places are three of the major flashpoints that we have, and three of the places that people will deny that we have any connection to. And it says right in the Bible, like, there shouldn't be any discussion over, and we didn't just take it, but we paid very good money for it, so that no one should ever say that it doesn't belong to us. But while we were in Elon Moray, we went up on the ridge. We went up what's called Scully's Ranch or Scully's Farm, the ridge all the way to the east, so far to the east that it overlooks the Jordan Valley. It overlooks where you can see the Yabok River from there, the river gorge in between the hills of Moab and of Gilad, across the valley. It's today's country of Jordan. And that's where we become Israel. That's where Jacob wrestles with God and where his name is changed to Israel. That's where we are, Israel, the people of Israel, still wrestling with God, still always arguing, sometimes over Shabbat, where I had like a great argument with my youngest daughter. I should have really, instead of getting annoyed, thought to myself, she's just being like a really good Jew, right? She's just arguing. That would have been if I was feeling not annoyed at that point in time. In retrospect, I thought, okay, arguing, I suppose, is just like built into our genes. But all through that day, meeting people who, by their very lives, everything that they do, not everything they do, but the things that they do, the underpinning of their lives is with giving to others, with thinking bigger than they are, even with what they're doing and trying to make a living. And there's no crime in making a living. You have to make a living. You have to be able to put food on the table. You have to be able to live decently. You can't give charity if you're getting charity. And work and working hard is a wonderful thing. But in the choice of what they do, in the meaning behind what they put in what they do, where they decide to live. So these people living up on this ranch, 10 families living on this ridge at the very edge overlooking, like I said, the Jordan Valley, and just overlooking so much all over. And it's not easy to live there. And they're living there. There's no one else around, but they're living there because they know that if they're not there, chances are that some Arabs will come and take the land and then claim squatter's rights. And then we have all these discussions about to whom it belongs, because there are no vacuums here. And also the Arab shepherds that come up from the valley below that then scout out the Jewish community so that they can infiltrate and do harm to the people living there. And so these 10 families, by their very presence there, are punching way above their weight. And they also have sheep, and they're raising sheep there for the meat market, for the lamb chop market. The place is immaculate. I've never seen like such a clean sheep farm. But the family's there. A woman showed us around, Ruth. She makes ceramics up on the top of this hill. It's not easy to live there. If you run out of some sugar, there's no like store or anything like that. And they have to all depend on each other. If anybody's going to leave, they have to let everyone know that they're leaving, so that someone takes their place on the guard duty. Or if they're going away for Shabbat, there's now 10 families there, so that they can make sure that someone is, if they have 10 men for a prayer quorum. And there's a sense of community, a sense of responsibility for each other, a sense of responsibility for the nation, because what they're doing out there is protecting everybody behind them, everybody in Elon Moreh and everybody further afield and down behind them. And it is the people on the edges who tend to make a difference. And these people have taken it upon themselves to do so. Now, having said that, there is also a different kind of extremism, the bad kind of extremism. And I was looking at, you know, the reports that have come out now about how newly elected President Trump has clamped down totally on Muslim immigration to the United States. Now, I see both sides of this argument. On the one hand, I understand why he's doing this. Okay, I'll get back to that in a second. And I understand the people who are getting upset. Definitely as a Jew whose people were denied entry as refugees fleeing Europe, people who were denied entry into countries and then ended up going back to Europe and getting killed, I can totally understand why those images of refugees being denied refuge strike a very, very deep and painful chord within us. And so here, this is where we have to start distinguishing between black and white, okay, and good and evil, because there's a lot of things in the middle. Just as an example, during World War II, the Germans and their helpers, Ukrainians and Poles and others, killed the Jews. The British did not kill the Jews. What the British did is not let the Jews into the land of Israel. The British had been given the mandate for the land of Israel specifically to create a Jewish homeland. And when we needed it the most, at the end of the 1930s and into the 1940s, where we were being slaughtered by the Germans, the British closed the doors and turned the Jews away. And as a result, many Jews got killed. So no, the British did not kill the Jews. But by not allowing us a safe place, they were complicit in Jews dying. Okay, so there is the absolute evil, which was the Germans, and there is the evil, yes, I will say evil, of not allowing people refuge. Now, let's take that into what's going on in the United States. Is that the same as what's happening now in the United States? There are most definitely refugees from the horrible wars going on in the mainly Arab countries here in the Middle East. Absolutely, there are people who are just looking to find a home. Unfortunately, within those people, which was not the situation with the Jews of World War II, there are also really, really evil people, ISIS and others who just want to use the cover of being a refugee to infiltrate into the wonderful countries that want to take the refugees in, both in Europe and in North America, etc., and then try and destroy or hurt or cause terrorism in those countries. Now, how are we supposed to distinguish? And here I'm going to lay the blame directly on the doorstep of the so-called leftists and liberals, because in the last few years, they have refused to make a distinction among Muslims. Any kind of discussion about Islamic extremism was not allowed. And so they have therefore caused all Muslims to be the same. Now, I know, and I'm sure that most of you are, I certainly hope that most of you listening know, that not all Muslims are the same, just like not all Christians are the same, and not all Jews are the same. There are good Jews and there are bad Jews, there are good Christians and bad Christians, and there are good Muslims and bad Muslims. The people who happen to be suffering the most from the bad Muslims are the good Muslims. Okay, yes, the rest of us also suffer when there's terrorism. Everyone suffers. But the people who are bearing the brunt of the evil that the bad Muslims, and when we say bad Muslims, I mean really bad Muslims. I mean jihadists and extremists and people who will kill anybody and everything in their way, okay, in order to have a caliphate and global jihad or whatever it is, whatever ideology it is driving them. And the people who are suffering the most are the good Muslims, which is why a lot of them are fleeing their own countries and are refugees to begin with. But who we tend to think of as the good-hearted people and the well-meaning people in the West, the so-called leftists and liberals, and I'm way down the road of thinking that either it is extreme naivete or hubris, or I don't know, maybe something else, that these are not good people, the so-called leftists and liberals, because what they have done now is caused a blanket name of Muslims that we have to be afraid of. Okay, now I'm sure that most of the people that are trying to get into the United States and into Europe are good people who just want a normal life. They don't want their children to be killed. They don't want their daughters to be taken as sex slaves. They just want a normal life. They just want to live. They just want to plant and be able to eat what they plant. But because the discussion was not allowed to happen, because any discussion that maybe there were some Muslims who were not good, you automatically tagged an Islamophobe, and the conversation was shut down. Now, I don't know if the so-called leftists and liberals are realizing that today, that it is their fault that that the new administration has now clamped down for 90 days on all Muslim immigration. They probably wouldn't admit that it's their fault, because one of the things that I tend to see about them is never, ever admitting that they're wrong. But we have this in Israel also, when the same kinds of people will say, oh, let's boycott Israel and let's boycott the products coming out of the settlements. And who ends up losing their jobs, like in the famous SodaStream story, the factory that is in Mishora Adumim, outside of Male Adumim, in a so-called settlement, and then forced to close down and move to the Negev. And the people that lost, because of BDS, and the people that lost their jobs were Arabs living in the area who then, for security reasons, couldn't work in the Negev, and they lost their jobs. So I'm caught between thinking, are they really ideologues? Do they understand what they're doing here, or do they not care? Are they so full of themselves that they don't care that ultimately the people that get hurt are the ones that they ostensibly say that they're going to help? Or maybe it's not about helping the people that they claim they want to help, the poor Arabs. Because if people really cared about Muslims or about Palestinian Arabs, about anybody for that matter, okay, they would take a bigger picture and say, where are my actions leading me? Okay, and sometimes it's not about being right and sticking to your ideology, but seeing a bigger picture and also understanding to compromise. When I look at Israel and I think, and I very, very much feel that Israel needs to put sovereignty on all of Judea and Samaria, because I look at Israel and I see that the people who live under Israeli sovereignty are safer than anybody else in the Middle East. That means Jews and Muslims and Christians. The umbrella that Israel spreads over people means that people here are safe. And one of the tragedies of the many of the 21st century is that people aren't listening. They're not listening to the everyday Muslims who are saying the extremists are bad for us. They're hurting us. Please listen. And many of them have to be very brave in order to say that, because they're living in societies, not Israel and not America, where saying that can get them killed. So we have to help them. But by just not having the discussion, by refusing to have the discussion that there are elements within the Muslim and Arab world that are horrible, horrible people and have to be stopped, inevitably the people who get the most hurt are other Muslims themselves. And if we know this now, and I'm not an intelligence officer, if I know this, baby, you know it too, and anybody can know it. If we keep doing something, even when we know that it's wrong, then really who's to blame? If we know that this so-called Islamophobia is just to hurt your average, decent Muslim and Christian and Jew ultimately, and we keep doing it, then the people who are doing that cannot call themselves good people anymore. They're just stuck to their vision of whatever it is and not helping anybody. I got a copy of an SMS, an internal message that was sent from the Rav Shatz, from the security coordinator of a community called Eli in the Shomron, a community that I'm very familiar with because my daughter and son-in-law and grandchildren live there. A wonderful community in the heart of the Shomron. And there was a terrible accident because of the rain and the slippery roads. It was a terrible accident. A very, very early Friday morning in a bus near Ma'ale Levuna went off the road, and two people were killed and many other people were injured. And the bus went down into a gorge, like 300 feet down the gorge in the middle of the night. There were Arabs from a neighboring village who were the first ones to call the authorities, who went down there in their pajamas and the rain and the mud. And then other people came, and what the security coordinator of Eli put out, saying how he saw people in his own community risk their own lives and to go down in, again, also in undershirts, whatever it is. They were called out of their houses. They ran to help other people. Volunteer to help, to get down there, to move the bus, to go into the bus, to find the people. Scenes that are not simple, to take people up many, many meters in the mud, also risking their own lives in terms of falling or getting hurt, on ambulances, on stretchers, to the ambulances, including one of the ones that One Israel Fund had given, waiting on the road in order to take them to the hospital. An entire network of people, both Jews and, as it turns out, Arabs from the neighboring village, who went to help people who had fallen. So these are like the trees, right? Everybody just looks like they're just standing there, except that inside there's this potential for unbelievable giving, for unbelievable life when it's needed. So here in the dead of winter, when things look dormant and things look like there's nothing going on, if you came into the world right now, you would just think that the trees are all, I don't know, just like logs standing there. So with Tu B'Shvat, the birthday of the trees that's coming up in just a few days, and what the month of Shvat shows us is the potential, just like from the trees, each one of us has the potential that we look like, eh. But when given the opportunity, we can burst into life and we can burst into goodness. And that's what all of us need to be doing. What inside us, even when it's cold and dark, and a lot of things in the world right now are cold and dark, and a lot of things can look very, very frightening. And it is up to us. It is up to us to bring that out, to bring out that light, to bring out that goodness, and to make sure that we can distinguish between what's good and what's bad, and also take a stand. All right, and not just abstain, okay? Abstaining means that you're letting the bad guys have their way. So all around me, I see so much goodness. It's so the opposite of what people think is going on here. What's on the news about the settlements and the settlers and the terrible people here, it's so not like that. The people here are so good. Perfect? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. God did not create a world of angels. He created a world of human beings. The Tanakh is all full of the flaws of human beings. And Judaism, which I love to the depth of my soul, is a religion that's made for human beings. And we don't always get it right. A lot of times we don't get it right. But what I see around me here is a greatness of spirit that never fails to move me. On another trip that I had last week, we went to the Pinachama, we went to the warm corner and gave cookies to soldiers. And the woman that was giving out cookies to soldiers, she had that shift, is someone I've known for a long time, someone whose son was killed in the army years ago. And this is how she gives. She gives to other soldiers. She gives to other people's sons. Because really, just one bullet separates her from the rest of us. And we went to see the film in Kfar Etzion, the bravery of the Jews that lived here in 1948, who lost here in 1948. We lost Gush Etzion, which is why it's apparently not ours, because the Jordanians killed the Jews here and ethnically cleansed the rest of the Jews living in Judea. And that's why I'm here now, because I will not let ethnic cleansing determine where Jews can live. So we saw the greatness of their spirit and the victory, the ultimate victory of us being here today. And when we went into the hall to see the film, there's another bereaved mother, someone else that I know whose son was killed in a training accident in the Golan Heights in 2009. And on the way from the warm corner to Kibbutz Kfar Etzion to see the film, we passed by the bus stop where the three boys were kidnapped 2.5 years ago. And I spoke about their mothers and their families. And there's a sign there that says Rachel Mevakal Baneha, which also happens to be from Jeremiah 31, how the matriarch Rachel is crying for her children, and Hashem promises that we will come home one day. But Naftali Frankel, who was one of the three boys, his mother, Racheli Frankel, whom I had the total honor of interviewing a couple of years ago. So it was like, you know, right, Rachel is crying over her children. Another matriarch, another mother, Rachel, is crying over her children. So I'm starting this day and thinking, wow, this is like bereaved Mother's Day. We're just going from one place to the other, from one place to the other. But nowhere do I hear bitterness. Nowhere do I hear anger. I hear grief, and I hear tremendous sorrow and loss, but everywhere there is not talk of revenge and not talk of more death, but talk of how to, or action, not just talk, action of how to make the world a better place, how to take whatever quality their children who are no longer living had and bring it out so that they never really die. So like the trees that in the middle of the winter look dead are still bursting with life. And that's what we can do. We can learn from nature. We can learn from God's world. We can learn from trees, and we can learn from each other. And we need to learn from each other. And we need to stop with like the generalizations and the fear of moving out of those generalizations and deal with life head on. All right. There are the good and there are the bad. Which side do you want to take? And let's have the discussion over who is good and who is bad and not be afraid of it. Because ultimately, I believe in a world of peace. And maybe I'm incredibly naive, but when Judaism talks about the Messianic age, oh, what that means to us is an age of peace. It's in our prayers. It's in our thoughts. It's in so many of the things that we do. We just want people to live in peace. But by ignoring reality, by trying to paper things over, by shutting people down who are not trying to be mean, they're just trying to say, this is wrong. And if we don't show that this is wrong and it doesn't get fixed, things will get worse, not better. That we have to do that. We have to do that in our personal lives, not sweep things under the rug, and we have to do it in our national lives and in our universal lives. Otherwise, all we are doing is saying, well, what I believe is right, and I don't want to hear from anybody else. And we can't do that. We can't do that. We have to be open to reality. So I don't know what's going to be with this immigration law, and I'm sure that quite a few people who should have found a safe place are either going to have to wait or perhaps not even get that safe place. And ultimately, who is to blame for that? Who is to blame for what's happened and now this generalization that that means that people who need a place of refuge are not going to find them? So I wish this administration Godspeed in being able to separate the wheat from the chaff, the good people from the bad, to distinguish who needs a home and who can come and make America great by their worldview, by their appreciation of America. I think that's something that native-born Americans don't always understand. And I, even though I was born in the United States, as a Jew with on my shoulders always Jewish history, the gratitude for countries that have let us in when we've been thrown out of other countries, I think it's no coincidence that that's why some of the most patriotic and people who love America the most are Jews and are other immigrants, because we know the other side of it, and we don't take it for granted, and we don't have a sense of entitlement. So it could be that some of these people who want to come in are going to be amazing citizens and amazing patriots and really help, you know, because America is that wonderful melting pot which makes it such a great country and all the different cultures and all the different ideas. But first and foremost, you have to make sure that nothing bad creeps in. It's the same thing that we have here in Israel all the time. Yes, they racially profile at Ben Gurion Airport, at Israel's international airport. They do, because we have to, because there are certain people who are more likely to blow up a bus than others. And that's just the way it is. So you can say that it's mean, you can say that it's cruel, and you can say it's discriminatory, but that's the situation that the world is right now. So I wish all of our leaders all around the world the wisdom to be able to make those distinctions. And I hope that everybody who needs a safe place finds a safe place. I've got one. I'm under the umbrella in the land of Israel. I'm under God's umbrella. And so even on a rainy day, I am just safe. So thanks for listening, everybody. A little bit of Eve's Peeves, a little bit of Chodesh Tov of the new month. And of course, so the interview that I had done last week and it pre-taped last week is going to come up now with Rachel Rotenberg, the wife of Jean-Pierre Weil, the philosopher, illustrator, author whom I interviewed last week. And what does she do? She works in wood. So it is the perfect part of today's show. Wood, wood, being when the trees are dead, that's maybe when they're most beautiful and most useful and can be just used, you know, seen as this lovely creation and really as a part of art. So there's just more to trees than meets the eye. Have a wonderful week, everybody. Eve Harrow, thanks to Ben and thanks to Tabitha. Enjoy the interview. That's it for today from me live. Eve Harrow, Rejuvenation on the Land of Israel Network. Always, always so happy to hear your feedback. Eve at thelandofisrael.com. Have a great week, everybody. Goodbye for now. Eve Harrow on Rejuvenation for the Land of Israel Network. And I'm in Tikal with Rachel Rotenberg, who is a sculptor. Now, think about what you think sculptor means. And now we're going to hear from Rachel what it really means.
I work with wood primarily, though sometimes I add other materials. My work is abstract, very, very accessible. I've been doing it so long, it's almost like asking a fish, what does water look like? And they're like, what do you mean? This is what I live in. So what do we think? I think that with sculpture, you need to stand in front of it and experience it. Images are great, and that's what we need to do when we're artists, because not everybody can see the work that we do. But it's a compromise for me. Being a sculptor is about the process of making sculpture. I do it because that's a process that is enlivening to me, challenging. It teaches me. It's a funny thing. In my life and in the family, my family of origin, we're all very practical, do-it-yourself kind of people. That's something that my mother taught us and instilled in us, that to do things, to make things, to fix things. Raising five children and running a business and all of that, putting dinner on the table every night, getting all of that in order were skills that I learned from a very young age, just how to do things, how to get a lot done in the course of a day. But in my studio, I am completely impractical. I am intuitive. I follow myself into places that I wouldn't know existed. And that's very exciting for me. And so different than even my thinking in every other place in my life is very concrete.
Right. So you mentioned about being concrete, but you also use, do you use that in your work? Do you use concrete in your work?
Since I moved to Israel, I've been thinking about materials and integrating myself more into this place that I have been dreaming about living all my life. Back in the States, I used vines in with the wood. It's also a wood, but it's a different thing. But here I've started to use cement. I don't analyze why I do what I'm doing, but I see that I'm living in a world surrounded by stone. And in choosing cement, I'm choosing something that I can manipulate, I can put pigment into, I can choose the shape and how it fits in with the wood. And I've just begun this, and I'm really excited by the possibilities.
It's interesting that you make that connection, because you said that it's since you've come to live here. And, you know, it's like some of us who live here feel that this is an environment that's so out of our control in so many ways. And here you are using a medium now that you can very much control. You can shape it, you can color it any way you want. But the main medium that you use for your art is wood. I love wood, because every piece is so different. But it's something that was once alive, but when you're working on it, it isn't anymore. How do you relate to the wood when you're carving it? Do you still see it as something that was alive in terms of the grain, in terms of the age of the wood, the type of the wood? Or do you just see it now as something kind of cold and something that you can work on the way you want to work on it?
It's definitely not cold. Wood is never cold. What I would say is that my main material is wood lumber. So it already has been cut into very specific forms, 2x4, 4x4, I still think in inches, though it's shifting over. And what I think that I am doing is actually putting life back into the wood. I take this wood that comes from a very organic, comes from a tree that is entirely organic, and it's been sliced into these geometric shapes. And then I take it from there, and because it's in geometric shapes, I can reform it into an organic form that I have imagined and drawn in my book, because the way I start off always is with drawings. Whatever I can dream up, I can build out of these geometric shapes of wood. And then when you look at it, you don't know that it came from 2x4s. I could show it to you. But I've had people come up to me, and I had a woman come up to me once. She said, I worked with trees. How is it that you found a tree that had many different circles of wood in different directions? And I looked at her and I thought, wow, that's an interesting question. How could you even think that? But my point really is just that I think I'm putting life back into the wood in a completely different form.
Where can people see your work? I know you've been doing this for a long time. You left a lot of work behind in America when you moved to Israel. Where can someone find your work?
I'm just beginning to find places to exhibit my work here in Israel. I have to build up a network. The best place, the easiest place, actually, not best, to see my work is on my website, which is rachelrotenberg.com, and there you can get a feel for what it looks like. In the coming year, I hope to start having exhibits here in Israel, in Yerushalayim to begin with. And if you're really inspired, send me an email through the website, maybe, and you can come out and visit my studio in the Jerusalem area.
You know, but I look out the window here, and there's barely a tree in sight. There's a few olive trees, some gnarled olive trees out on the hills, and some people planted gardens with a tree here, but it's not like you're living in the middle of a forest. So there's a real dissonance almost between the medium with which you work, which is the wood, and the trees from which they come. Are you like a foresty person?
So here's where my concreteness comes out. I love nature. But I'm not somebody who is, I'm not going to pretend that I go out into the forest, I fall in love with the tree, and then cut that tree down for me, mill that tree. I actually have heard a sculptor say that because we work with materials. I love the wood, and the wood I use, what do I love about wood? It's incredibly forgiving. Because I work in an additive process, I can build anything that I want. I don't need to find a tree that has a particular shape in order to build the sculpture that I want to build. It has pushback, the material itself. Something like cement and plaster, when you mix them up, they're a liquid and they will take whatever form you put them into. There's something about the process of working with these sticks of wood, these pieces of lumber, that it talks back to me as I talk to it, it talks to me. The cement, it's formless, and I need to choose the form to put it into, and it takes that almost, I'm going to say 90%. Beyond the 90% is, there might be these beautiful little patterns because of the way I put the color in, and there are lovely surprises that come out, but it's the wood that really grabs me.
You make woodworking sound almost like, wood sculpting sound almost like parenting. Like you're working with something that's got its own, the life of its own and a personality of its own, and you can impact it to a certain degree, but only to a certain degree.
Well, I actually think of it, the whole sculptural process reminds me a little bit of parenting. The nice thing about it is that if I make a mistake, I haven't hurt anybody. So one thing that Jean-Pierre would say to me, You know, he said, you know, we go into our studios and I can, you know, I can be actually pretty violent with the wood. What does that mean? I'm taking a chainsaw to the wood. And if I cut off the wrong piece, it's okay. Of course, you can't do that with children. Mm-hmm. But like children, when I decide to start working with a drawing, I'm making a commitment to that drawing. When I build it and work really hard to make it the best it can be and look for the surprises that will come out as I'm building, because I have to stay aware and be, as I mentioned before, there's this conversation back and forth. Like I'm making a lot of the decisions, but there are decisions that come to me from the material itself. And if one of my pieces, you know, if something breaks about it, it's like cries to me, and that's where it's like a child, and I fix it and I feel better. On the other hand, if I don't do a good enough job, I really need to bring it back into the studio. There's, sometimes it looks like it's finished, but a month later I realize there's something wrong with it and I have to rework it because it demands that I give it the best that I can do. And the other thing that it is kind of, well, I mean, it's not about raising children, but in my studio, what I have found is that the pieces that are in there, I cover them up with sheets for two reasons when I'm working on the next piece. One is that the space becomes very dirty when I'm working. And the sawdust is just flying all over the place. But the other piece is that they each have a very strong voice. And if they're all talking to me, there's no room for the next piece. And that was a discovery I made maybe 10 years ago. And I realized that when they're uncovered, I can't let my mind drift into the space where something new will emerge.
That almost reminds me of the Friday night table where we cover the tuchalot, we cover the bread when we make the blessing on the wine, because we say, like, you know, we need to be able to concentrate on the one and not, I don't know, there's some reason why we do that. And that's just what came to my mind, that sometimes you do have to cover something in order to be able to concentrate on something else. What kind of wood do you work with?
I work with cedar at this point. I actually brought a whole lot of cedar with me on my lift when we came to 3 years ago. But when that's done, I'll find a local wood to work with. I'm already in conversation with the local lumber yard. And, you know, I look forward to playing with new materials and seeing how they work. I have worked with a few other woods. Cedar is just such a good building material. We'll see.
And we were saying before, the cedars of Lebanon, right? It was such a good building material that that's what they used to build the temple, no less. So I guess it's kind of an old Israeli idea to do that. Do you find that living here, you said you started working with concrete since you came to Israel. Has your work changed in any other way?
It's elements of concrete inside the work, so I'm not working with a whole piece of concrete. It's hard for me to tell. You know the book, Wherever You Go, There You Are? Mm-hmm. That's something that seems true to me. I think I would need a few years to look back and see what has changed. I'm feeling at home here in a way that I never felt at home in the States, though, and I was born in Canada, and somehow none of those places were ever home to me the way that Israel is a home to me. It's hard for me to see. I'm really too close to my work to see that kind of thing very clearly. Good work, really excellent work, is emerging, and that's where my focus is.
Okay, thank you so much, Rachel, and I feel bad for all my listeners who aren't seeing what I'm seeing and the magnificent work, which, I mean, maybe because so much of my life is as a mother. I've learned so much more from my children than from anything else I think that I've done. And I am seeing so much femaleness in your work here. You know, a lot of it is round. And I said that to you when I first walked in. It almost looks like a womb to me, one of your pieces. So I guess everybody sees it through the perspective which they, what motivates them or what, the lens that they look through. So go on to the website. Okay, everybody? RachelRottenberg.com.
One T.
RottenBerg. And see for yourselves. So thanks for listening, everybody. Eve Harrow, Rejuvenation on the Land of Israel Network. And thank you to Ben and to Tabitha. And I hope this wasn't too hard for you, everybody, because this is a very visual show in a medium that's very not visual. But thanks for sticking with me, and goodbye for now.
The best place to stay in Jerusalem is at Windows of Jerusalem Vacation Apartments. Check out their website, www.windowsofjerusalem.com. They've got beautiful 1, 2, 3, 4 bedroom apartments in the best location in the city center with the most beautiful, breathtaking views. And I mean breathtaking. I've stayed there a number of times myself. And I'm telling you, there are few places anywhere in the city where you can take it all in to this degree. The view, the location, the great apartments, plus the wonderful staff will truly make you feel at home in Jerusalem. Book your stay now at windowsofjerusalem.com.
When I was growing up, I would read the books in the second half of the Old Testament, and sometimes I would get a little bit lost in all those prophecies of Jeremiah, Isaiah, and so on. That all changed the day I stepped foot in the land of Israel. As I harvested grapes and olives and more on the mountains of Samaria, the words of the prophets came to life right before my very eyes. Today, you could be a part of this phenomenon too. I am Caleb Waller, and I'm inviting you to step into the pages of prophecy by joining us in Israel. Go to our website, that is hayovel.com, H-A-Y-O-V-E-L.com, to connect to this amazing opportunity.